Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name's Paul Yock. I'd like to say hello on behalf of the ByDesign program. We have a great evening coming up. David Kasich will be introducing our guest in just a moment. I wanted to just take a minute, though, to say, first of all, thank you to Wilson Sonsini and Price Waterhouse, who are sponsors of this event, and to Wendover for having the use of David Kasich for the evening. This will be a great session. One other thing is, if you can please join me in turning your cell phones down to vibrate or quiet, because we are making an audio recording for podcast. We'll run maybe 50, 60 minutes with the interview itself, and then there'll be a chance for questions in this mic, which will be back on the stand. And after that, we'll have a little reception. So please join us for that. And with that, I'll turn it over to David.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks very much. Well, you know, those of you who've been to Innovator Workbench programs before know that we take a deep dive into medical technology of all sorts. But I've often thought that, you know, perhaps the most kind of quintessential, futuristic, cool thing about medical technology is embraced by the notion of robotics. And we're fortunate to have with us tonight Lonnie Smith, who, if anybody, is responsible for the widespread adoption of medical robots. It is Intuitive, which has been under Lonnie Smith's direction for all these many years. It's truly an amazing story. And Lonnie, before we get to the Intuitive side of this, which you're best known for, you and I first got to know each other when you were at Hillenbrand. Before that, you were with Boston Consulting Group. Give us just a brief overview of your career before Intuitive, how you got to Intuitive. I mean, how you got to BCG and then on to Hillenbrand.
Well, and I've actually picked this up from Gary Guthart, who's our new CEO, our CEO, who's been with the company from its inception, before I was, actually. When we first met him, he was a young PhD out of Caltech and had his degree in applied mathematics and wave theory. And I said, you know, Gary, how did you get involved in robotic surgery? And he says, well, you got to understand, I believe in the pinball theory of life. And he says, you know, you're kind of headed in a direction, but things change your direction. And he says, you know, so I was at SRI. What do you do with a PhD in applied mathematics? Well, if there you go to work for a research organization like SRI. And he says, I was out playing basketball. And we were talking about servos. Now, only at SRI or in Silicon Valley would people be playing basketball and talking about servos. But anyway, Ajit Saw was running the program and says, hey, you know a little bit about this. Why don't you come give me 10% of your time? And anyway, that led to him getting a majority of his time. And then Russell Hirsch and a group from Mayfield Fund, including Fred Mall, all came over, wanted to license the technology and convince Gary to join them as an engineer. And Bill Nallen, who's here, was also one of those guys out of SRI. And anyway, my life's a little bit the same. I grew up in Idaho. My father had a small construction company, had an eighth grade education. You know, I worked on construction. I thought I'd be a civil engineer. And then when my sophomore year in college, my father was killed in a car accident. So then I came back and helped shut down the company and finish up the jobs. But I took on some responsibility immediately out of necessity. And when I came back, I decided, well, you know, maybe I didn't want to be a civil engineer, so I decided to be a double A. So I changed my major to electrical engineering. That was a long time ago. We were just barely moving from discrete components to integrated circuits. And I then joined IBM as an engineer. But went into a program because IBM was growing so fast that where they were identifying young graduates to become managers. And so I became a first-line manager at IBM and decided to go to business school. That was when I first kind of got introduced. I applied at Stanford and Harvard and the U.S. Army inducted me instead. So I went to, just during Vietnam, and so I went to the Army. And there I learned that you can learn what people do wrong as well as they do right. And so there's, you learn from everybody. And so it was a good experience. So it was also a good experience in terms of of kind of being stripped down to nothing and having to again reassert and build your relationship with other people in terms of whether you brought value, and you brought value only by what you could bring to them in terms of leadership. And so I went through OCS and served in the military, got out. Military offered me what's it called when you become a general, a regular army commission. I passed that up. Wanted to go back to business school, but it was kind of mid-show. I came back here to Palo Alto, actually worked for IBM, and then decided to go to Harvard instead of Stanford. And out of there, I was introduced to the Boston Consulting Group and joined the Boston Consulting Group out of business school. And then I had was a young guy there, and maybe a year, and they were selling a project. By default, I got this project. Actually, Mitt Romney and a guy named Charlie Ferris were selling a project to Hillenbrand Industries and asked me to come along, so I came along, and we said we have this kind of experience. Of course, we were adding all of our experience together. It was a total farce, but what happened is that then they sold the project to Outboard Marine Corporation, which was a worldwide distribution strategy for Outboard Marine Corporation. And what would be more fun, powerboats or hospital beds and caskets? Well, Romney and Ferris went off to do that one, and I ended up with caskets and hospital beds. And so anyway, but that was also, I did that project. Then they asked me to come, recruited me to come to join Hillenbrand Industries as a senior vice president at age of 32. And I said, and I wasn't going to do it except for that BCG made an offer that I could refuse. They wanted me to run a project for Siemens, which was a study of the U.S. computer market, and run a study in Europe for Siemens, the computer market, and run a study for Fujitsu in the U.S., where I had to go to Japan twice a month. So I was either going to be in Europe or I was going to be in Japan, and in the U.S. a little bit. And I had three children, and it was time to change jobs. And so I joined Hillenbrand.
So you chose Batesville, Indiana.
I chose Batesville, Indiana.
So you came from a company that was perhaps the least futuristic technology imaginable, hospital beds. What was your first reaction when you were recruited or approached about the Intuitive job? What was your reaction to robotic technology itself, which in those days was in a very early infancy? Was the robotic technology part of the appeal, or did your days at Hillenbrand make you skeptical about something as far away in the future as robotic technology?
Well, I guess I'd say that actually, when I did the work at Hillenbrand, we looked at both had essentially a product that disrupted their market and took into leadership. Hillrom invented the electric hospital bed. And when we brought in, their market had slowed. And what we really found is that they had a great adoption curve for the first generation, but the life was too long. And so they had to innovate to shorten the life so that the curve didn't look something like this, but looked like this. And that's what we did. And even Batesville Casket had invented was a sealer casket, so it was air and water tight. But it did displace everybody else, and they consolidated the market essentially through distribution, created a dominant market. Both were clear market leaders. And so, having done adoption curves for both of those and seeing the threats of adoption, like cremation coming in, so I was interested. I was familiar with disruptive technologies, but just in a different sense. And so when I saw this, I decided to move on. I decided that it was kind of Groundhog Day, going from division to division. And I told Gus Hillenbrand. I said, the two of us were running the company as office president. And I said, I'm going to look out. I'm looking at other opportunities. And he thought I was nuts. And but both of them were a big company. I had three offers, and they were both other big companies over $1 billion. And then there was this little company out here that came out and met with Joe Mondotto, actually told me that, you know, one thing about working for a startup is all the arrows come from in the front, none in the back. That was mostly true. But Russell, and so anyway, a group of VCs plus Fred Mall, and I, I began to talk to a few docs about whether they thought this was going to be, was a viable option. Now, of course, what the market plan said we were going to do is we're going to do minimally invasive cardiac surgery, wouldn't have to split the sternum, and we're going to do it on a beating heart, and we were going to track the heart. I mean, this thing, this device was going to track the heart. Bill was kind of working on that project, actually. I guess being naive helped a lot, you know? I mean, you just didn't really realize all the risks. Financially I was stable. So I decided, you know, this sounded a lot more fun than working for another large organization, which was going to be more of the same. So I came, and
so how much of the risk that you're talking about was technology, and how much of it was what I might call a perception risk? It seems to me that robotics in a world in which of advanced medical technology has an interesting place. It captures the imagination and seems to embody the best that medical technology can do, but it also generates a fair amount of skepticism, especially among those who think it's just never going to be real. How much was that an issue for Intuitive in its early days? Does it remain much of an issue today, do you think?
Well, I think it was a big issue in the beginning, and I think it's less of an issue today, but I don't think it's ever, adoption of a new technology goes through stages. As I said, we started out to do cardiac surgery, and we were really, that's where we were headed. And we built the first systems. We sold 10 the first year to Europe, and we got Jeffrey Morris. We got the essentially the innovators, right, who will try anything, but they have a real short attention span, so they're not likely to help you build a business. They'll buy one and play with it, thank goodness. And this is where just sheer good fortune comes into effect. We built, the engineers actually, this team built, and this was not luck, they built a complex product that had 10,000 discrete components. It was supposed to have no software. There's going to be no software in the system. It's all going to be microcode. It had 1 million lines of code. and had 3,500 subcomponents, and we did it. We took it from the early prototypes, which were really crude prototypes at SRI, to a shippable product in 3 years. And
how many iterations?
We had no idea. Well, there are three iterations. I mean, there was Lenny, which was named after Leonardo. There was Mona, the Mona Lisa that was written by was painted by Leonardo, and there was Da Vinci, which the engineers named. We tried, our two-man marketing team tried to come up with a better name, but they couldn't, and so we went with Da Vinci. But here's where good fortune came in. So that was just a wonderful team of people, which we still have. I mean, the blessing of this, so the good fortune that I had was I came into an organization of just really incredibly gifted people. But we sold a system to the University of Frankfurt for cardiac surgery, and they were doing cardiac surgery with it, coronary artery bypass with it. And there was a young urologist named Johann Binder who decided he could do a laparoscopic prostatectomy with it. Had never done a laparoscopic prostatectomy in his life. It took him, he actually did an incision, put in the cannulas, and sutured it back up, and it took him 13 hours. Now, most people would dismiss that, and at this time, when I'd run to people at the airport, any cardiologist or cardiac surgeon who was familiar with Hartport, they'd go, "How long does it take?" And Hartport, of course, was a high flyer at that time, but took a long time. Ancord had a lot of aortic dissections and ultimately veiled. But that was the beginning. It was born very ugly. And true, you know, true opportunities often are born ugly. I have a sign on my office that says, most people miss opportunity because it comes dressed in overalls and it looks like work. I mean, it's ugly and it looks hard. And so, you know, anyway, that was the first step. He did it, and he will never be terribly fast. I mean, he probably got down to 3. But there was some other doctors decided they'd try it, and one of them was a Dr. Manny Menon at Henry Ford, who had just come over as the chief of urology out of Boston. And he tried to learn to do it laparoscopically. He went to France. He trained under at Hospital Montsouris with Guy Valenciennes and Guiano. And one day, Guiano kind of put his arm around him, and he was a very talented laparoscopic surgeon, and says, you know, Manny, you're a really nice guy, but you're a lousy laparoscopic surgeon. And so he was open to a new technology. So he got a friend, Vatacuti, to create an institute and buy the first robot for Henry Ford. And then they started doing it. And then he published his results. And his results were spectacular. I mean, the positive margins went from 23% to 9%. This he published his first 200 with the Da Vinci against his last 100 open, and they compared them. It dropped from 23% to 9%. So cancer removal improved on it. The next thing that he asked patients what they wanted, and they said, "Remove the cancer. I want to be continent. I want to be potent, and everything else, you know, kind of second." Yeah. But so continency improved by about 73%, if I remember correctly. Potency improved by about 65%. Complications dropped from 20% to 5%, and time in the hospital dropped from about 3.5 days to 1 day. So this was a good story, and the reaction of the medical community was, he's fudging the numbers, that can't be right. But others started doing it, and so that was our first real application. I mean, it had compelling value to both the hospital and to the patient.
So I want to talk about that, but let me save that for a little bit, because in a world of...
So I always take him off his track here.
Yeah, comparative effectiveness. I think that raises some questions. But talk about that transition from a company focused on cardiac surgery to a company focused on prostate surgery. First of all, how closely were you working with these doctors as it was migrating out of Frankfurt into France, back into selected doctors? And did you see that? Was the reaction within Intuitive one of great joy? We finally found our niche. Or did you resist it, saying, "No, wait a second, we're a cardiac surgery company. Who cares what these crazy urologists are doing?"
Well, I think it was mixed, and I don't know there was, but I'd say there was some. In fact, the founders, one of the founders' attitude was, "You can't get a decent multiple on urology." That's a quote. I mean, you know, and there was some disagreement, and ultimately, and we did a business plan actually called ISI2, which was essentially a restart, but decided not to pursue that. My attitude was, hey, listen, you got to do what you can do, what you're bringing value to, and so I wasn't so hung, I wasn't so committed to the cardiac piece, but that ISI2. Was the beginning of the plan of to create Hanson Medical, which is another robotics company in the valley, it's just hard to know. At the time, it's easy to look at success in the rearview mirror. It's very hard to see it going forward. Otherwise, all the VCs would have 100% hit rate, and they don't. And it's because these things are born ugly, and even some great ideas don't succeed. And you know.
So what was the process by which it made its way out of the cardiac surgeon field into the prostate surgeon? How quickly did that happen? And again, were you interested bystanders, or was there anything you could do to promote that? I'm not certain where you stood on FDA approvals or anything like that.
Well, the whole FDA process was an interesting one because we had laparoscopic approval, and so we... And on a conference call, somebody asked us if we had approval for prostatectomy, and we said, We felt it fell under our laparoscopic approval. Seemed like a reasonable assumption. Next thing we know, we got a letter from the FDA, right, saying, you don't have approval for prostatectomy. Now, that was initiated by a competitor. But, and so I met with the FDA and I said, we were really fortunate, we had a new head of devices who didn't last very long, but he was a doctor out of New York, and he wasn't caught up in the bureaucracy well. And so I said, you know, my first question to you is, how does the agency listen to quarterly conference calls frequently? Because that's the only place we'd say we had approval. And they, you know, everybody kind of put their head down. And so I said, well, you know, here's the deal. We've got the AUA coming up, and people are going to present papers on prostatectomy with the system. Now, you can give us, we can either say, we don't have FDA approval for this, but if you want to learn more about it, go talk to Dr. So-and-so. We can sell it off-label. Or we can train, we can actually have FDA approval so we can actually train surgeons. And I guess my question to you is, which is best for the patient? And Bernie Statlin, who had that position at the time, says, this is amazing. He says, you'll have approval before the FDA. Now, he didn't last long because of that, probably, but he got us approval. And so in terms of its adoption, you know, we one of the things we did was really smart at the beginning and fortuitous and lucky. I mean, it was we tracked every procedure, so we knew every procedure that was done, where it was done, and what procedure was done. And so as we tracked it, you know, I would put it down, you know, monthly, okay, how many procedures done it. And we could see this. Cardiac was kind of going like this, and urology, prostatectomy was going like this. And so then, people here remember that, I came from BCG, so I've done adoption curves, so we started doing a diffusion curve to see how well the fit was. Well, the fit was great. And so started projecting out what it would look like in adoption. You know, we come to full adoption in about 6 years. And so we've never since that. We still continue to track every procedure, and we draw adoption curves for those that show consistent growth. And in terms of, you know, we are the least credible person to promote a procedure. I mean, the manufacturer has a vested interest and is... The hospital is the next least, and the doctor is the next. The most credible person to push adoption is another patient, and we were fortunate that we hit prostatectomy, which is a disease of men of a certain age group and quite prevalent, and so it's very likely if you're my age, you know men that have had prostate cancer. And so in terms of adoption, that was one very different than mitral valve repair, which is hits men and women. It's a much smaller disease state. So we're fortunate that we hit a disease state that hits a demographic, and that demographic can communicate. And so a diffusion curve is just a diffusion curve. The adoption curve is you drop the ink into a vessel, and it's diffusion of molecules. That's exactly the way adoption works. It's exactly the way it works. And the next big hit we went with that's growing fast is gynecology. Guess what? Women are better communicators than men, and it's a disease state that hits the same age group. You know, especially for hysterectomies, for myomectomies, sacral copoplexies. So,
but it seems to me that in order, before you get to that diffusion curve, before you get to the point in which patients can ask for this, you've got to hit a certain critical mass. It doesn't have to be a huge critical mass. You've got to get to a certain point. In the early days, what was the reaction of surgeons to robotic technology per se? You once said to me that Da Vinci takes surgery beyond the limits of the human hand, which is an interesting statement in a clinical specialty where physicians particularly prize tactile sensation. What was the early arguments like trying to convince surgeons to adopt this technology, because they're not the most eager adopters of new technology?
Well, it's different by surgical specialty. I mean, cardiac is the most conservative, and it was hard. The other one that was most difficult for us at that time was actual general surgeons, and not because it's just the laparoscopic general surgeon, wasn't interested in having somebody come in that required a lot less training and was able to do what they did. And now that we added wrists and 3D vision and stuff, so we had, our contact with general surgeons was literally, let's just say when you felt a tension in the room, they were not excited about this. But once the urology community started to see the benefits, you're right, but the critical mass starts with one, and one telling another, and pretty soon, and it occurs in clusters where we have systems, but of course hospitals also, once they had data, promoted it, or at least tried to create awareness, and so I think it varies. But then once people see the success in urology, that was pretty easy. It was easier because we looked at the gynecology before, and didn't look like a great opportunity. But pretty soon, and our first penetration into gynecology was for oncology, where there was really a compelling reason for endometrial cancer, and then it moved to benign, and something like sacral colplexies, where you're doing a vaginal prolapse, there's a lot of reconstruction. We can bring a lot of value to that too. So,
one of the other catchphrases of robotics in its early days was that it makes good surgeons great and great surgeons better. The classic adoption model in medical devices to get some key opinion leaders. But I know that there were some great surgeons who really didn't like the notion of making mediocre surgeons better surgeons. What was the adoption quickest among the non-thought leaders in the space? What was the reaction of thought leaders to
I would say
surgeons?
Initially we tried to follow that model. But it became very clear early that the early adopters would be not the one number one in the market, but somebody who had something to gain, not somebody who had something to lose. And so even hospitals, I used to use Memphis, Methodists, Baptists, you're going to go, we would have success with the number two who wanted to gain share from number one. And that proved to be true. I mean, Pat Walsh, to this day, who is the father of nerve sparing at Johns Hopkins, tells how I've got to have tactile feel and how he has the touch. I mean, it's on Charlie Rose's show. He says, I've got the touch. Well, wonderful. The fact is, and Miriam once told me, she keeps hearing Miriam Kretus here, as a general surgeon here at Stanford, she said, people ask, complain about, there's no tactile feel. But I said, those are people who don't use the system. And it's true. The people who are worried about tactile feel people who do not use the system, because the vision is so good. And the visual cues, quickly you replace it. That's kind of, but there will always be, and we're working on tactile feel stuff. It's a hard problem. It really is a hard problem. So I suppose if we can get both, it'll probably be better than one alone. But the people who complain about it are non-users.
Well, you were telling me before we started about an anecdote in the last couple of days about running into a surgeon from Houston while you were skiing. Tell us that anecdote and tell us when you hear from surgeons who are adopters and talk about it changing the practice of medicine, how does it change the practice of medicine for those who adopt?
Well, I was actually in Park City and I was skiing, running up the lift, and a couple got on with a child. And I don't know how it came up, but I said something. I guess they asked where I was from. I said California, but I was there with my, I have a house there, and I was there with my children from Houston, or my daughter from Houston, her kids. And she says, I went to medical school in Houston. I said, oh, really? That's interesting. I said, where did you do your residency? And she says, in Portland. And that's where they're from. I said, so that's where you met your husband. She said, I said, you're both docs? She said, yeah. So what do you think of the new healthcare legislation? I said, we're just trying to have a good day skiing. but I said, either one of you surgeons? And she says, he is. I said, what kind of surgeon are you? this gynec. I'm a GY oncologist. I said, oh, ever heard of da Vinci? He goes, use it all the time. And he said, you know, he says, and, it, and I'll tell you, it's totally changed my practice. And he says, you know, it just, and I know I've heard this over and over, the head of gynecology at Sloan Kettering. He said, you know, my patients do so much better. Now this isn't a compared to a randomized study, but he says, you know, my average patient with a rad HIS would best case, they'd leave the hospital after 3 days, mostly four. And he says, now everybody leaves after 1 day. He says, and it's, you know, it's just a huge difference. And so, you know, he said, and we do most of them, you know, again, women talk about, patients talk about what their experience was, and they talk to their peers and their friends, and that drives volume to those hospitals and to those centers. And so that's, and you understand the economics of a hospital. I mean, most hospitals don't understand that. They're high fixed, I mean, they primarily fix costs. And so the value of a marginal patient to them is huge, because about 80% of that drops, either helps cover fixed costs or drops to the bottom line. And so incremental revenue is a powerful driver. It is to every organization, but if you have that kind of fixed cost, it's the difference between a profit and a loss.
You said before that hospitals were actually the second least likely to push and promote, but a lot of people say that the success of robotics has come precisely because hospitals are looking for a kind of marketing catch or a marketing something innovative or cool in their marketplace. And a lot of the way people hear about da Vinci is not so much patient to patient, but on radio ads that hospitals run in local markets. How much has the hospital been a factor in aggressively promoting or adopting da Vinci precisely because they see it as a benefit to bring in new patients into their facilities?
Well, I think a hospital, you know, and they it varies across the board, but a hospital does, it's making a large capital equipment and does want to see it utilized. On the other hand, I would argue that all the any kind of things they do with the media are just awareness, and that the real compelling the credibility comes from another patient, and when people have a good experience, they talk about it. If they have a bad experience, they talk about it, and so you know I hear that a lot. Oh, they're, you know, this is just a marketing gimmick. That's from the people who are losing business to them. That's the people who failed to adopt earlier and are late into the market and have lost business, lost patients, and it upsets them. But patients get on the internet today. You know, patients get on the internet. I mean, if either the patient or their one of their children or their spouse, if somebody gets a serious illness, what do? I mean, I'm on there. You know, what are the options? And it's pretty quick. I mean, there's in gynecology, there's a Hister Sisters. There are just a lot of groups that are ready to share their experiences, and so that's the driver. And the doctors do it because they see the benefit for the patient. You cannot sustain a fraud. I mean, it may work for a little while. It does not work. It does not build a $1 billion business. It does not build, you know, it just does not. I'm sorry.
You raise an interesting point, which is as fascinating as technology is, intuitive success as a company has been equally impressive and fascinating to watch. Before that, let me get to one other question, because we talked about hospitals, talked about surgeons. The other, as you well point out, was the consumer appeal. I don't know if it's still there, but I remember last time I was in Intuitive's offices, there's a photo montage on the wall of all of the kind of magazine covers that has featured da Vinci robots. Paris Match, Life Magazine.
That was early on, yeah. That was in the very early days. Yeah. It got a lot of media coverage, especially in Europe.
Was that an unalloyed good, that early media coverage? What was your reaction to, and what was the the end result or the impact on Intuitive in its early days of that kind of consumer appeal. I know some surgeons who actually don't like direct-to-consumer advertising because they don't like to have patients coming in saying, how come you can't do this for me?
Or you know, asking questions. Oh, you're right. I don't know. I can't say. I think those things have a short half-life. And so, you know, that when you're beginning, you love to be on, you know, cover of Scientific America and you have those things. There were Life magazine and stuff like that. But it doesn't sustain anything. The only thing that sustains is patient value. I mean, and then that turning into actually a drive for demand. So, you can get a lot of, and we didn't ever have a, well, we did actually. We hired a publicity firm, lasted for about a year, and fired them. Because the fact is that the technology was interesting enough that it could get media coverage, but without our support or without anybody pushing it. But I think it's good for awareness, and we still try to do things that, you know, allow hospital wants to put a system into at some civic event to create awareness. We're happy to we have some systems we use for demos and with administrators and hospitals that travel around the country, we do put them in places where people can touch them and feel them, see how they work.
You've made the point to me many times over the years that Da Vinci's success doesn't come because it's a robot, but people adopt robots because it delivers great outcomes, great clinical care. When you're covered in the press, which seems to come at these things because of the razzle dazzle and the fascination with size. Do you feel that you're covered properly or appropriately in the general press?
It depends. I don't think we're, you know, I think there those that are fairly objective, and some that are, you know, just, you know, I mean, they're very thin. You know, so and so's got a new, you know, this newest latest technology. I think that it's a tool. It's a tool, and if it enables the surgeon to get better outcomes, then it's a good thing. But I don't and early on, I mean, trying to create awareness was important, and it creates another dynamic. People, this is both good and bad. It depends on where you're at, but you know, they're you know, hospitals are competitive with one another, and I hear about arms races and things like that. But my own belief is that I would rather not have systems in every hospital. I think hospitals that do little, if they don't have significant volume, they shouldn't have a robot. I mean, whether you have an open procedure or a laparoscopic procedure or a robotic procedure, you want a surgeon who does a lot of them. they will do a better job. And so, you know, I'm not anxious to have a bunch of systems where people are doing one a month. I think that's bad for us, and it's bad for healthcare, and it's bad for the patient. So I would rather, see. And I think that's one thing capital does do. It does consolidate markets. I mean, if the average urologist probably does one a month open. Well, that's not. I don't care what tool they're using. That's just not very good. Mm-hmm. So I'd much rather go to somebody who's doing three or four a day, banging them out. I mean, and if you go to the major centers, that's what they do. I mean, so these are doing, and they do it every, and they've got a rhythm. That whole team works together well. You know, it's a tool, but it is a tool that helps consolidate.
So I said before, the as fascinating a story as Da Vinci is, Intuitive as a company is equally fascinating and has been successful beyond all measure. You went public in 2000 during a time when very few medical device companies were able to go public, and I don't have to ask if it was the right move. I mean, for a long time, Intuitive was almost the Google stock of the medical device industry. Why did you go public? What did it do for you?
Well, you know, we went public because we needed money, and the VCs needed an exit strategy. So I mean, that's... You know, I'd much rather stay private, and we did not look like the Google initially. I mean, we came out at $9 a share, right? Something like $9 a share, maybe $10, I can't remember. And And we didn't have FDA approval. And so we were saying, it's in the mail. We've been through clinical trials. And the FDA said, had as a PMA. So we were on PMA track. We'd been through the panel. We'd done all the randomized clinical trials. We'd done everything. And we still didn't have approval because, you know, we'd gone through GMP, all the stuff you have to do. And we're on the roadshow, and I get a call from Phil Phillips, who was then deputy director of the agency, and he says, why is this a PMA? I'm going, I don't think that was our call. And he says, well, I don't think it should be. It's going to be too onerous on you. Now, this, I'm sure this is none of the regs. It'll be too onerous on you and too onerous on us. And I didn't realize, none of us realized, what a fortuitous decision that was that made. Because we thought, well, PMA, we're going to be a bigger barrier to anybody else coming in. But we would have had to done a clinical trial every time we changed the code. We now have 1.5 million lines of code. And so, you know, I mean, it would have stalled the development of it. And so, anyway,
Da Vinci was a 510K?
It ultimately ended up as a fat 510K.
With the laparoscopic, with what else as a
Well, predicate? The first predicate was actually a ESOP, and then, okay. but that was the issue.
It was ASOP, that's interesting. We'll talk about that in a second.
So we went public. The stock, I think at its all-time worst, hit, I don't remember, $4 a share?
That would have been a good time to buy.
$6 a share? I don't remember. Maybe it was six. And so then we bought Computer Motion because we had been in patent lawsuits with them.
That was in 2003.
2003. But the key point was is we were really good at losing $20 million a year. We become professionals now. And I had this... So in 2002, in October 2000, we got all employees together, and I had this line showed our revenue growth had gone from $10 million to $26 million to, I don't know, 50. I mean, we were on to $72 million. We're going to hit about $72 million that year in 2002. Anyway, it was 10, 26, 56, and 72. So it was a pretty nice trend, right? And I had a fixed cost. I had a hard time getting the organization, getting our finance people to break out fixed costs. We had fixed costs, and they were just runners on the same line, parallel to it, and above it. And I said, you know, let me just explain something to you. We will never break even. I mean, even if we have our cost of goods drop to zero, we will never break even. And so I said, you know, we're going to do something today. This is 2002. From this point on, we will not add another dollar of fixed costs for 1 year. Fixed costs are frozen. And after that, we're going to grow our fixed costs at half of whatever our revenue projection is. And we were profitable, not very, in 2 quarters. We took it.
In two quarters. 2003 or 2000?
In the second quarter of 2003, this was October, mm-hmm. Second quarter of 2003, we broke even. Then we bought Computer Motion and had lost $30 million the prior year. And so there was quick work. But we were profitable in 2000, or we broke even in 2003 with all that kind of added in. And then 2004 is the first year we really became, you know, became consistently profitable. But, you know, the value of managing business on a fixed, I'm not a fan of GAAP. I think it's BS. So on a fixed and variable basis, you know what a marginal dollar of sales is worth to you. You manage the fixed piece. Now we've migrated those together. Now, I mean, so we still grow fixed costs at a lower rate than we grow revenue. But, you know.
So you were trying to ramp up sales, trying to continue to develop product. How did you manage not to spend another dollar fixed? Year. Well, everybody has to work twice as hard.
Well, no, we just said, okay, we can reallocate these costs, but we're not, you know, you have no room. If you spend it here, you're not going to spend someplace else, and it's just a matter of, were people happy about it? No, everybody, we gotten into an attitude, and it's so easy to do, and it's even worse for us now a little bit because we're profitable, right, and quite profitable, and we got a lot of cash. A billion in cash, and so people, you know, think, well, let's spend it, right? But you know, it's a mentality. I'm a true believer that creativity comes from limited resources. the unlimited resources never, never drive creativity. The Japanese have a term for it, creativity over capital. But we've we do two things I think have worked really well from the beginning. Small teams of really smart people. And our optimal team is, well, Gary will say it's the minimal number of people that do the thing. But the best teams early on a project are five. You might get to six or eight. Then it begins to expand a little bit as you start, you know, as you got prototypes and stuff. But our projects start out with really small teams, but they're really good people, and they're people who've been through it at times. And one other advantage we've had that's been huge is people have stayed with the company. Even during the dot-com boom, people stayed with it. You know, the advantage of having a consistent team is you don't make the same mistakes over and over again, right? Every time you bring in new people, you know, and the other challenge, though, is to kind of maintain the culture, because we have this very strong culture, but we have all these people coming in from the bigger companies, and it's hard, you know, they're going, well, this isn't the way we do it there, or you get somebody whose first thing is to tell you not what how to add value to the customer, but what the regulatory requirements are. You know, we worry about that last. Now, we break the business into what we call core versus context. Now, that's, again, a Jeffrey Moore concept. We call it core versus support. But core are those things that create value for the customer. Now, Moore says that startups are 80% core and 20% context. And context is like taking a shower. I mean, it's hygiene. If you take it more, you can take 10 showers, but it doesn't create any value. And Sarbanes-Oxley, finance, most of the things you do in reporting, it's the same in engineering, are support. So we allocate, and this isn't perfect, 80% of our costs. Budgets go to core functions, engineering, sales, actually, it's the first place we allocate it to, because that drives revenue, which then allows us to have more fixed. So we allocate costs first to those core functions. And because we know there's support in the core functions, it turns out we're about 90% core functions, about 10% go into our support functions, into things that don't touch the customer. And we know, because we know there's, and we're probably still 70-30, but Marshall, who's our CFO, really does a good job of controlling that. And it makes a big difference, because people know we're investing our money, our expense dollars, our people, everything else, into those things that touch and equipment, the technology, and the customer. And that's where we create the value.
So I want to talk a little bit about Intuitive as a publicly traded company. Was the company, just to get some clarification, was the stock price a not particularly stellar performer until the Computer Motion acquisition for the first 3 years?
I think it became a performer when we turned profitable.
Because
now it became obvious that we'd survive.
It was a hugely successful.
Well, the other thing is that the cash flow has always been, that's again my problem with GAAP. There's our cash flow as a multiple of earnings. I mean, you know, this has been I give credit to this. The business model that was built by with some tweaks is the same business model. The business model that was created in the first digital business plan, while we may have been wrong about cardiac, and we may have been wrong about microcode versus software, the business model was a good business model. I've seen few businesses that can grow at compound rates of 60% and still throw off cash. I mean, that's pretty incredible, and this business has. And you know, and with things like 123R, where we spend stock option expense and stuff, we got huge non-cash expenses, which make no sense. So I think we're valued on a cash flow basis more than we are on a reported earnings basis.
But so what was it like? I mean, so around 2003, then Intuitive began a run of several years of simply extraordinary share price growth. What was it like managing the company then? And obviously, everything that publicly traded, the CEOs of publicly traded companies do, is directed toward improving shareholder value. But my gosh, you're also trying to introduce an amazingly complex new technology in this space. What was it like running a company that really was seeing share price multiples that were unheard of in the medical device field.
Well, let me change that. We do not. We believe we have a hierarchy of value. And the first place we want to create value for is our patients. The second is for the surgeons and the hospitals who provide the service. We want value. I mean, we want to help them build their practices. We want to create value there. Because if they don't, they won't buy the system. And the third we want to create value for is our employees, the people who touch the product, who create the value. And the last are our shareholders. Now, every employee is a shareholder. But if you get those turned backwards, if you're focused on your shareholders first, it's hollow. I mean, that doesn't create any value. There's no substance there. I mean, come on. If we create value for our patients, for our customers, for employees, we will create value for our shareholders. And so we really are, I mean, and Bill sent me, Nalan sent me an email once, I can't remember what, but it was on, he forwarded back to me an email I'd sent out when our stock jumped, took a huge jump. And I sent out an email to the employees saying, don't focus on this because it's probably going to go down. Now I was wrong, this isn't where we focus our time. Don't get distracted about this because, quite frankly, the market does these things. Of course, we did. We dropped. It did go down ultimately with this with the 2008. We went from $350 a share, $340 a share to, I don't know, 90 or something like that. But people didn't. You know, I don't think people got rattled about it. They understood, and now we're back. But the thing is. If we create value in that order, we'll create value for our shareholders, and I think our shareholders are pretty happy. But that's
such a contrarian view because, although I once knew a guy who ran a publicly traded company, which remained nameless, and the stock went from like 20 to 72, and I asked him what it was like. He said, "Well, I always thought we were a $35 stock. So whether when we were 20, I thought we were a $35 stock. We were at 72, I thought we were a $35 stock." So he didn't get that excited, but. When you were at 340, or frankly, when you were at 240, going to 340, did that allow you to do things that you couldn't do if you'd had a averagely performing stock?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we don't use the stock to do anything. I mean, we're not using it as an acquisition vehicle or anything like that. I think it has made a lot of our employees have done well. It actually has. Because I refused to split the stock. Now, maybe the current management will change. Maybe Gary and this team will decide that it's not a good idea. But I'm a Warren Buffett fan, and I splitting the pie into more pieces doesn't make much sense to me. On the other hand, it's been hard sometimes to recruit employees. That they come in and say, the stock is $200 a share. I mean, I can get a lot more shares from ABC company at a buck a share. You know, my buck a share. I point out that, if the stock price doubles, you'll have $2. If our stock price doubles, you'll have $200. And so, but very sophisticated people still they struggle with it until they experience it. Then they go, yeah, I understand. I mean, what we do is we say, hey, a grant is worth, it's essentially a stock option is a 10-year interest-free loan on this amount of money, and that's the number of shares times whatever the strike price is. And then I have a little chart that shows, okay, if your stock grows up, is it 10% compound over 10 years period, or 15 or 20, this is what it'll be worth. And you'd like to, you want employees to see this as a way to put their kids through college, to buy a home. I mean, this is a valley. It's a place that you can't do it on salary. I mean, our 10-year evergreen ran out. So we were out, this year saying we need more options. There are those that understand and those that don't. But those that live, kind of the Midwest, they don't understand why these are so important. Well, this valley, they're really important to retain and and reward your employees. But the people who work there are not, they're not focused. I mean, I'd say that our people, they feel good about it, but I don't think that's not the reason they come to work.
So you may have, the answer to this may be implicit in what you just said, but the stock did so phenomenally well, but was there any downside in that phenomenal success to being public? You said you needed the cash, but anything you didn't dare do because you were a publicly traded stock and were afraid of the impact on the share price?
No, I don't. We really don't manage the business that way. I mean, I don't think there's anything that we say, oh, we're going to do this, and what does it affect the stock price? We say, what is the effect on the business? How does it affect our patients or our customers? And and are we being fair? And but nobody's kind of running around saying, what's the impact on the stock price? Because, quite frankly, that's a pretty short-term view. If we don't manage the business right, the stock price isn't going to do well over a long time anyway. So if that's the case, sell your stock now.
We're running up against time, but I want to get to other points. 10 years ago, there were two major robotics companies in this space, you and Computer Motion. And 3 years later, in 2003, you acquired Computer Motion. Talk a little about why you did that deal and what impact you think it had on the evolution of robotics as a technology as well as a kind of market phenomenon.
I'm not sure it had much of an evolution. Computer Motion, this is an interesting kind of thing. Computer Motion made a company called ASOP, a product named ASOP, which was a voice first. Well, first it became a voice controller to control the scope. So the scope, the surgeons could say, ASOP left, ASOP right. It could control the endoscope. So it removed an FTE in the OR and gave the surgeon direct control. The only problem is it was a little bit slow. And so often you see the surgeon grabbing and moving around. So it was essentially a scope holder. But for the finer movements, then they'd say left, right. Well, the upside of that is who buys an endoscope holder? Who buys that? Highly skilled laparoscopic surgeons, right? I mean, the people who buy it are people who do laparoscopy all the time. So when Computer Motion decided that they would go in, they're going to get into surgical robots, they went to the same customers and said, what should this look like? And the customers told them exactly what you expect. They said, make it do it just what I do. You don't need wrists, just straight sticks are fine. And you don't need 3D vision. I'm used to looking at us over here. So just and so what they did is they essentially put a computer between the surgeon and the patient, but did not bring any additional value. And so Computer Motion, but they did create a lot of early intellectual property. So we had a bunch of intellectual property, they had a bunch of intellectual property. And when they were losing the marketplace, what do people lose when they lose the marketplace? They sue.
You.
So they sued us. In fact, they tried to stop us from going public. In fact, we went to visit them. We can start negotiating this, and the attorneys can start talking about a license, about cross-licensing each other. But I can't. I'm about to go public. Well, look, as soon as I get back, I get a letter suing us because they thought they could stop us from going public. I remember at the end of the meeting, I said, look forward to working this out. And he says, and the current CEO said, in the best of all worlds. Well, so we got so we went public anyway, and it didn't stop us, but we got a lawsuit. So we sued them on some patents, and we won in Delaware. But they were suing us on 10 patents in the state of California. And let me just say, going before a jury with patents that doesn't understand the technology, this is a tricky thing. We tried to settle it a couple of times, just got nowhere until they became desperate. I mean, they were losing money, and it wasn't clear where they could raise money. I really didn't want to do the deal. But finally, it just came obvious that, let's get it behind us. And so we gave them more than I thought it was worth when we gave them a percentage of the company and took it. And then we tried to look at, could we combine the technologies? And there was somebody called, their vice was called, I forgot. Zeus. And somebody came up with the Zeus. Well, it looked like the Zeus. And so we ended up essentially taking their patents and but taking some of their people and consolidating everything because they were losing so much money. We couldn't. So we brought everybody here, shut down operations in Santa Barbara. It wasn't a pleasant thing.
And, they had three units: they had Aesop, Hermes, and Zeus.
Oh, well, that
can
was
you
that,
buy,
that,
can you buy any of those today?
There was other. You can buy a used Aesop, but Hermes never was a product, never FDA approved, and Zeus, no, Zeus. I don't know who would want to buy it anyway. But
so I the reason I asked the question about the evolution of the robotics industry, because again, it was you two guys, and more recently we've seen a bunch of new companies who are all in and around the space of robotics, Stereotaxis, Hansen, Corindus. Do you consider those companies competitive? And why? I realize that you bought Computer Motion because of the IT issues, but why has M&A not factored more into a strategy, particularly when you had such a robust share price that you could have used as a currency to make those acquisitions?
Well, you know, I guess most acquisitions don't yield very good returns, and two, we truly are a surgical company. We bought some IP. Mm-hmm. We've from companies NeoGuide. We acquired NeoGuide, which was essentially no longer an operating company. So we took some of their engineers and some of the intellectual property, and we've done that multiple times. We have been an acquirer of things that will enable us to practice the art. But things like these other companies are typically not. I mean, Stereotaxis controls is a magnet, big magnets that control things through the devices through the arteries. I know
more
them well. It actually does moves the device, and you know, and actually Kaminsky, who's the CEO there, used to work for me at Hillrom. Hillrom reported to me, and he was an executive at Hillrom, and Hansen is focused on vascular. In fact, we have a cross license with Hansen on that, and it's just not a place we're going to get to, and it's just very different than what we do. Now you got to be careful, right? If you say, you know, if you have a disruptive technology, you live by it and you die by it. And we've seen it in this valley a lot. It doesn't, you know, you drive down Central Expressway or Silicon Graphics. Things happen here fast. So you can't be. But on the other hand, I don't think it's appropriate for us to get into, you know, into areas that just willy nilly. And so you know we we're very interested in kind of other technologies and things that can apply, but we're not. When you're growing at 60% and you're just trying to hold it together, acquiring another entity and the distraction of management is a huge distraction. And I've been there, done that.
So just one or two other questions, then we'll open up for questions here. But I know that cardiac surgery remains a kind of presence in Intuitive. Talk us a little bit about where Intuitive sees the cardiac surgery applications of Da Vinci and all the three of the companies that I mentioned, Stereotaxis, Corindus, and Hansen are all in the cardiac space. Wouldn't it be a great way to get into the cardiac space by acquiring another technology rather than trying to migrate Da Vinci 10 years down the road?
Well, they're essentially into the interventionalist
right.
state, the side of it, not the surgery side, and it might be. I guess I think that on the cardiac side right now, I mean, we do bring a lot of value to mitral valve because we can do a closed chest mitral valve repair, and we have a 95-98% repair rate versus open where it's about 50%, and so you're not accoutred the rest of your life, and so you know, it's quality of life. It's it's a Now, there are only a few centers that there aren't a lot of centers doing it, but it is and it's pretty, like the Cleveland Clinic right now, I think 60% of their valves are now done with da Vinci, and we will replace them, and pretty soon, there'll be most of them done. The other area, I think I'm still a believer, and there are people in the organization who think I'm nuts, but I'm a diehard. It's hard to get it through my head. I still believe we bring such value to the patient in cardiac surgery that there's a real opportunity. And one of the centers that has demonstrated this is University of Maryland, where Rob Postman is. Now he's the chief, he's at 42, he's the chief of cardiac surgery at the Boston Medical Center, and they brought in a guy from Johannes Bonatti out of Austria to replace him. But his paper, the Annals of Journey, Annals of Surgery, he compared doing what he calls a mini CABG with open surgery, and this is beating heart. And I think this is where it's going. I think this is where the clinic thinks it's going to go too. Cleveland Clinic is where we bypass minimal invasive on a beating heart, bypass the arteriographs, the Lehmann LAD, and we stent all the saphenous veins. And what you would use a saphenous vein for. So you stent all the non-arteriograph blockages, and the advantage of that is, well, out of his paper, they did a comparison, and what they found was 99% patency, 1 year post-op, because all those saphenous veins didn't block, and they typically do. 85% reduction in major adverse cardiac and cerebral vascular events, and a 7 to 10 day reduction, well, 83% reduction in intubation time and a 7 to 10 day reduction in length of stay. Not a bad story. And so I think it will come. The cardiac surgeons are so conservative and the interventionalists have just kicked their rear ends. And it's again, we use a formula. We say patient value equals efficacy divided by invasiveness, perhaps squared. And that problem is stent isn't very invasive, and patients will pick it every time over over splitting their chest if they can.
A long time ago, you said to me that robotic adoption will take decades, not years. We're now several years since you said that to me. Where do we stand now, do you think, in terms of robotic adoption as a technology? Are we still at the early stages, or is it possible to talk about mature robotics?
I think that, I hope not. I think that when I said that, I still believe it, and it's true. People looked at it and said, well, laparoscopy just, well, what they really said is lap chole, adopted in a matter of 5 years. Prostatectomy is about these curves are all a little different. They're different slopes, different rates of adoption. Actually, mitral valve's pretty long. Prostatectomy, as I said, because of the demographics, is about a 7-year curve. Well, as you get these curves, the major curve you see is going to be a lot of little curves, and so we track these as they go along the curve. So robotics will be adopted procedure by procedure where it brings value. Now, that's not static, right? I mean, the technology is not static. It's as long as it improves. I started my career at IBM, and I remember getting out leaving the Army and being invited down to L.A., and Frank Carey, who was then chairman of the board, got up, and he had a vessel, glass jar, and he says, there's more memory in this glass jar than we have installed throughout the world. Now, I can put in my pocket more memory than they had installed in the world at that time. I mean, it's just, what's happened, I grew up with mainframes. That's where it started. I mean, if we can't constantly evolve it, it's going to get smaller. It's going to get more specialized. I'm not smart enough to know where it'll go, but I do believe that it will, and if we don't take it there, somebody else will. And it will probably, we'll see at the right time, you'll see these things from interventional cardiology to surgery. These things will. But one will become very blurred.
One of those interesting things about the Intuitive story is that you would think in a technology space like robotics that we'd see constant leapfrogging and new companies obsoleting. To what do you attribute Intuitive success to stay ahead of and well ahead of the rest of the market for all these years? There's really been nobody to come along to significantly challenge Intuitive in the last 15 years.
Well, you know, first of all, one, there's a lot of intellectual property. That's a barrier, but it's not a. But it's also just look at, you mentioned, we actually got profitable on about $120 million in. If you looked at our retained earnings, we crossed over before we lost $120 million. Hansen's lost $220 million. Stereotaxis has lost more than that. I think 300. I've looked at it. I mean, it's a huge. There's a huge barrier here, and now somebody will come along and change that paradigm. I mean, if you can come in and create a PC, you know, the world can change pretty quickly. And the thing I worry about is that we'll sit around and say it's inferior, and dismiss it, and then you wake up. I mean, when we were building the company. J&J, all of them, J&J was in looking at, you know, and brought all of their top guys. I mean, Nick Valeriani, but the Longstreet, chairman of multiple yeah. chairman of groups, and they were looking at us and Olympus, everybody was in, and they all walked away going, we don't get this story. Yeah. And you know, and VCs would come and they'd say, you know, that's a technology looking for an application. And they were exactly right. And thank God we found
them. Well, on that note, let's thank Lonnie. This is a fascinating story. We could do it. We're gonna take some questions. If you could make your way to this microphone. But I did want to ask you one question I didn't get to in the regular part of the interview while people walk through the thing. In the wake of the recent discussions about healthcare reform, comparative effectiveness has loomed large, particularly for the device industry. And I have to say, every time I've talked to somebody about comparative effectiveness, the technology they've cited to me as being the prime example of why we spend too much money on technology that delivers too little is robotics. Two questions. One is, how do you respond to that? Have you heard the same thing? And number two, do you think robotics will be in the crosshairs as we evolve this discussion and this process about comparative effectiveness?
I think the people who are saying that are the people who've lost something. I mean, you know, one of my slides I use the laggards. Is Dunn, who was the head of the patent office, who said in 1902 or whenever it was, you know, all that has been invented, or Harry Warner, who says, "Who in hell wants to hear actors talk?" I mean, capital advancement is always taken by capital replacing labor, and this capital does, and it will evolve. I believe we will win on comparative effectiveness. I have no doubts. I mean, I could cite example or example. I mean, whether it be tours. I mean, of what if. The thing I worry about in comparative effectiveness is where people start with a preconceived and are out to prove that they don't, they have an agenda. And there's a lot of that going on right now with clear agendas. So, I mean, but on a level playing field, we will win. And I've run, just taking some simple numbers. I've taken how many hospital beds, you know, how many patients per day, the total cost, taking all AHA data, and, you know, the cost per patient day is $3,000. You just divide it through. It's $2,998. I mean, whatever. It's $3,000 a day. Well, most of that's fixed. So let's assume that you can save $1,000 a day. If we just take what we're doing in prostatectomy and what we've improved in hysterectomy and the cardiac, and you know, make some assumptions, pretty conservative assumptions of saving a couple of days per patient, and then you take the capital an extra hospital bed. Today, Stanford's going to build a new hospital. It's going to cost them $5 million per bed. Maybe it's $4 million. I might be off on that. But the average one costs $1.5 million. Now, it's going to last 40 years. Now, you're going to replace some things in that process. But let's say it's last 40 years. On our systems, let's say assume it lasts, I've certain assumptions that it run that last somewhere between 8 and 10 years. And so you have to replace them. But I'm just used to carrying costs to the hospital, carrying costs to that, carrying costs to the bed. What do you save? How many beds can you save by eliminating those number of days? Now, the operating costs I've seen are $1,000 a day, not $3,000 a day. And if we can convert, I've run it at 25%, 50%, 70%. I think my 70% numbers, if 70% of the kind of major procedures could be converted to minimally invasive procedures, we would save, the net savings would be $17 billion a year. So I think we can win on this. I think it will only get better, but the noise will be loud, and you know I use the example, you know, the first application of a steam engine was to pump water out of mines. Why? Because you couldn't get a mule. It wasn't as efficient as a mule, but you couldn't get a mule down in the mine. But then it pretty soon was driving locomotives and steamships. What was the response of the sailing industry to steamships? Well, they created the Thomas L. Lawson that had 7 sails. Its first, so if some is good, a lot is better. First trip across the Atlantic, it didn't steer very well. It wasn't very maneuverable. It did a little bit of rough water. It sunk, killed 15 of the 17 people, and that was the end of that. So you know, people will fight change. You know, Einstein said the penalty for being a heretic. I use this with a heretic in his youth. He was an expert in his old age, and the people like Pat Walsh and stuff, the people who invented something, still cling to that paradigm, and we got to be careful. We don't cling to it to the paradigm we built. Because it's a dangerous space.
Question?
Yeah. I feel like every couple of years you see an article in the news about someone working on telemedicine and mm-hmm. telerobotics, but nothing ever visible comes of it. Do you see a viable place for telerobotics moving forward?
Well, the military is, you know, and I think they've got several of the pod program. They got a lot of things they're working on. I personally, medevac them out, right? I mean, robotic. I do think as the technology evolves, it, you know, I'm not going to be surprised if it happens. But it's not what the state is today. Now, what I do believe that telementoring and teleproctoring are real, and we have that capability in our current system. And so it's and Miriam has done something where she gets on the and you can be in the OR. You can see what's going on in the OR. You can see what the surgeon's seeing. You can communicate with the surgeon both by voice and by writing on the screen. And there will be a lot of things that occur around that. I think, but at this stage, I'm the value of having a surgeon far away. I don't know that, you know, if you can afford $1 million piece of equipment, you probably can afford to have a surgeon there. So I don't think we're there. But to say we never, that'd be the last one to say that. You know,
couldn't you right now do a Da Vinci procedure?
Oh, we could.
In South Dakota from a Chicago hospital.
We could. And the internet's gotten better, and the speeds are getting better. All those things make it possible. The question is, you know. Well, I think the technology, I think. You know, I mean, I grew up. You know, the concept of phones that you could see yourself on. I mean, those things were, you know, they're popular mechanics, and but they're reality today. And so, I'm the last one to say that won't happen, and it won't be economically viable to have a really, you know, somebody who's done many of them. Right now, though, surgery is a choreography. I mean, you want to do surgery where that whole team is orchestrated well, and each knows their role and does it well, and you know, just dropping in. You know, I tell Gwandi's latest book. He takes a shot at us, but most of that in that book, he says, you know, having checklists where you just, first of all, when the surgeon comes in, introduce himself. Everybody introduces themselves to the team if they're, you know, if they're not working together all the time. And what is their, you know, what's their role? And these things are important.
Technology side, people still want that surgeon in the, well, even if it's in the next room.
I guess right now, for me at least, I'd prefer to have he or she nearby.
Great. Next question.
Hi, I'm curious about your board of directors and the evolution. What role they played in the early years of the company, how they've evolved over time, how they serve the company today, what you look for in a director, and how they help you get your job done.
We look for people who can bring different viewpoints to the board. I am very opinionated about boards. I think the board has two roles. Now, that's not what you're going to get over here at Stanford Business School or University of Chicago or Harvard. And those roles are who runs the company and who owns the company. And if they don't have, I mean, a board cannot run the company. When somebody tells me, how did the board decide the strategy? I'm going, where have you ever, I mean, a board member who shows up, let's say, max of six times a year, but 4 to 6 times a year, has a whole lot. Is going to come and set strategy for the corporation? I don't think so. They certainly ought to question it and bring viewpoints and ask questions. But you know, I can't as a board member, and I sit on some boards. I can't do that. And the other, so they've got to make sure they've got the right person running it. And the second thing they ought to do is, if in fact it's worth more in somebody else's hands than it is in the current ownership, then they ought to sell. And sometimes you don't quite have a choice. It's things in today's world where you've got to get an unfriendly tenor, and if the company's not performed well, but I don't think, you know. And so we've got some MDs on the board. We have some people at tech. We have people who have like Alan Levy, who's done multiple startups, and was chief technology officer at J&J, and you know who's you know so. I look for employees. Really smart people is my preference. Very smart people who are highly dedicated and committed to supporting the team.
So you're stepping down as CEO. Are you going to retain? Are you going to stay on the board?
I'm chairman of the board. I'll remain the chairman for a while.
Will your role change?
Well, it clearly has changed. I've moved from a decision maker to an advisor. Now, I try not to cross that line, and I think some people could.
Let me ask one.
But I really do. I mean, I think that my decision, my role is now an advisor, and so Gary, you know, Gary and I talk a lot, but it's his call.
Let me ask one final related question to that. Board aside, how did you put together, and what did you see the role for your scientific or medical advisory board, particularly in the early days when it was not a widely adopted technology?
Well, I'll try. I won't use any profanity here, but. That was just, scientific advisory boards are, at least for us, were a joke. And what do you try to do? You put on a bunch of big name surgeons and things so that you can go and say to your, when you're trying to do an IPO, these are people who are on our scientific advisory board. They never show up. They're too busy. They don't have a clue of what you do. So we put one together, and I can't remember who they were. And I certainly know I can't remember any value they added, but the value often came from people you didn't expect. I mean, some user that was young, didn't know any better, and did things that you didn't expect, and you learn from them. And you know, it wasn't the big names often that were really created the value. Well, I'd say it was never the big names that created that really brought value. It was somebody who was really smart, really aggressive, and wanted to, you know, was driven to make a contribution.
Well, who created more value than Lonnie Smith? Lonnie, thank you very much. thank you all for coming. And there's a reception in the back.
Thank you.
That was great. Thanks.